From the home of the Codebreakers and the birthplace of modern computing, this is the Bletchley Park podcast.
Welcome to the June 2021 episode of the Bletchley Park podcast, Fallgelb, Part 2. By late May 1940, the Germans have arrived at the French coast, cutting the Allied forces in two. Their risky invasion plan, Fallgelb, or Case Yellow, has paid off. For the Allies, things will only get worse. An evacuation of the British forces from Dunkirk, the capture of Paris, and the ultimate humiliation at Compiègne. It also marked a turning point for Bletchley Park. The attack led the Germans to change their Enigma procedures, which had been exploited so successfully by the Hut 6 team. It took a creative approach, as well as some lazy enemy operating procedures, to restore Bletchley Park's capability in reading German messages. In the second part of this special It Happened Here episode, Dr. Thomas Cheetham guides us through the dramatic world events that could have seen Bletchley Park lose the ability to read Enigma for the rest of the war. Special thanks go to Gus Munro and Dr. Ben Thompson for voicing our archival documents.
This is Bletchley Park. It happened here.
Germany calling. Germany calling. Here are the Reichsender ambush. Station Bremen and Station DXB on the 31.
Major forces of the Allies. And as to the result, there is now no doubt whatsoever. We were confident of victory from the very moment when it was announced that our forces had entered Holland and Belgium for the purpose of frustrating the Allied attack which had been planned against the Ruhr. The lessons of Holland and Belgium afford final proof, if any further evidence were needed, that small nations would do well to shun like the plague any offers of guarantees or alliances from Britain and France. In the majority of cases, these instigators of armed strife gave no help at all. But in the cases where they did try to render assistance, the results for their protégé were far more lamentable than if they had simply done nothing at all.
8:55 Eastern Daylight Time, and Columbia and its affiliated stations bring you Elmer Davis and the news.
After another day of furious fighting in which each side scored local successes, the Battle of Northern France and Western Belgium is still undecided. The principal German success was the drive of a motorized column as far as the French Channel port of Boulogne, where Prime Minister Churchill said heavy fighting was going on. If this German force should manage to hold the port, it would of course be a serious blow to the Allies, but how strong the German column is, we don't know. And the French, coming up from the south, fought their way into the outskirts of Amiens. So it is still too early to be sure whether the Allied Channel Army will be cut off by the Germans or the German Channel force cut off by the Allies.
What are the French and the British going to do about it?
What they need to do is launch counterattacks on the sort of salient that's been created by this German armoured breakthrough, with obviously the aim of cutting off the panzers who are at the spearhead and destroying those forces. And that's what the German High Command and Hitler are really scared is going to happen. And this is what they try to do. But the problem is the Allies are in such a bad state at the moment, it proves impossible. Their strongest forces have been in the north. They've advanced into Belgium. They've fought battles against the Germans in Belgium. And now they've had to retreat under pressure back to France. And now they're in northern France. But they're in such disarray. They're disorganized. A lot of their vehicles are broken down in many cases. They're low on fuel and ammunition. They're having to deal with the fact that the roads are full of refugees at this stage, so they can barely even move, let alone organize a strong enough counterattack. And we have those problems of command and control and communication and coordination, which the Allies have had from the beginning. Gamelin in his headquarters, he isn't capable of communicating to his commanders quickly enough. They're using telephones and messengers instead of radio. It's not responsive enough. And so whenever the Allies spot an opportunity, by the time they've got their act together to do something about it, it's too late. And there are several occasions when this happens. So the upshot of this is there are some local counterattacks which do worry the Germans, and there is potential to cause a problem there, but they never go very far. There's a counterattack on the south of the salient by the division under General de Gaulle, who will be obviously very important later in the war as the leader of the Free French. That comes on the 17th of May. It takes a certain amount of ground, but it doesn't get too far and doesn't come close to cutting off the salient. Similarly, on the north side, from the British on the 21st of May comes their biggest intervention, which is the Battle of Arras, where, again, they advance, I think, about 8 miles using Matilda tanks, which are quite heavy, heavier than the German versions, and mostly impervious to their anti-tank guns until the Germans bring up their anti-aircraft 88 millimeters, which destroy these tanks. So that's repulsed, but from the beginning, they're not really putting in heavy enough attacks, and they're not coordinating them effectively enough to cause serious problems for the Germans, although it does cause some worries.
So it's sounding pretty bleak, actually, for both the British and the French.
Yeah. The French leaders, Gamelin and Georges, who is the general in charge of the actual French army, at this stage, they seem to have both decided that the battle is lost and France is going to be defeated. There is a famous incident where Churchill actually visits from Britain and meets Gamelin and asks where the strategic reserve is, and Gamelin replies, there is no reserve, which is true. They're making a real mess of the battle. They're actually dismissed on the 19th of May. Gamelin is replaced by Maxime Weygand, who is a former French commander-in-chief. He comes over from Algeria and doesn't do much of a better job, actually. Gamelin has planned these counterattacks, and Weygand arrives and immediately cancels all of these, waits 2 days and then comes up with a plan which is virtually identical. But it's 2 more days that they've wasted, not responding to the Germans while the Germans are breaking through. And the Germans actually reach the coast on the 20th of May. That creates this pocket. The troops to the north are cut off from the rest of France. French troops are obviously cut off from their supply lines. And that's obviously an incredibly dangerous situation. It's a situation that Manstein intended to create with his plan. And it's worked. And this is sort of battle of annihilation, which the Germans at this stage in the war anyway are very, very good at. The British are surrounded and the situation is looking so grim. This is when they start thinking about actually cutting their losses and retreating. Lord Gore, in charge of the BEF, makes a decision to withdraw on the 23rd of May. And meanwhile, on the German side, Guderian has been forced by the High Command to pause again to let the infantry move up. But within a couple of days, his tanks are unleashed again and they move north and they're cutting now into this pocket to capture the ports and eliminate all the British and French troops which are there. The Germans move north, they besiege Calais and capture it after a few days. And this is when you get actually one of the most controversial episodes of the whole battle, which is that the Germans are poised to take Dunkirk. This is the last major port in Allied hands. And if they capture Dunkirk, it's all over. And then the German panzers are ordered to halt. And they stop and watch while British and French troops reach the port, put up a defensive perimeter, and actually that's the reason they're able to hold it. There's all sorts of reasons been put forward as to why this takes place. The simple answer seems to be, again, the High Command and actually General von Rundstedt, who is commanding the German army group in question, decides that it's too risky to keep pushing forward. And it has to be kept in mind here that the Germans know they have to go and fight the rest of the French army. Even if they take out the BEF and all the best French divisions, there's still a lot of the French army that still needs to be dealt with south of the River Somme. They don't want to be wasting tanks and men at this stage if they're going to need them later, especially if the battle in the north is won. And it may have helped also that Hermann Göring, who's in charge of the Luftwaffe, makes his quite typical pronouncements to Hitler that the Air Force is going to be able to sort all this out without the army getting involved. This isn't true. And actually, the Luftwaffe itself is in a pretty bad state at this stage. They've lost a lot of aircraft. They're running out of energy, just as the army is. In the end, the RAF is actually going to put up a pretty decent resistance in the skies over Dunkirk. And the Luftwaffe is going to cause damage, but not fatal damage, to the evacuation as it takes place.
Der Vernichtung der dort im Kampf gestandenen englischen und französischen Armeen ihrem Ende entgegen.
The German High Command announces the battle is coming to an end and the British and French armies are being destroyed. The British army is deserting its weapons and is retreating to the sea.
A number of appeals for recruits have been issued today. The Admiralty want men experienced in marine internal combustion engines for service as enginemen in yachts or motorboats. Others who have had charge of motorboats and have good knowledge of coastal navigation are needed as uncertified second hands. Application should be made to the nearest registrar, Royal Naval Reserve, or to the fishery officer.
days and nights, ships of all kinds have plied to and fro across the channel under the fierce onslaught of the enemy's bombers, utterly regardless of the perils, to bring out as many as possible of the trapped BEF.
This is London. Yesterday, I spent several hours at what may be tonight or next week Britain's first line of defense, an airfield on the southeast coast. I talked with pilots as they came back from Dunkirk. They stripped off their life jackets, glanced at a few bullet holes in wings or fuselage, and as the ground crews swarmed over the aircraft, refueling motors and guns, we sat on the ground and talked. As we sat there, they were waiting to take off again. They talked of their own work, discussed the German Air Force with all the casualness of Sunday morning quarterbacks discussing yesterday's football game. There were no nerves, no profanity, and no heroics. There was no swagger about those boys in wrinkled and stained uniforms. The movies do that sort of thing much more dramatically than it is in real life. When the squadron took off, one of them remarked quite casually that he'd be back in time for tea. About that time, a boy of 20 drove up in a station wagon. He weighed about 115 pounds. He asked the squadron leader if he could have someone to fly him back to his own field. His voice was loud and flat. His uniform was torn, had obviously been wet. He wore a pair of brown tennis shoes, three sizes too big. After he'd gone, I asked one of the men who'd been talking with him what was the matter with him. Oldie replied, he was shot down over Dunkirk on the first patrol this morning. He landed in the sea, swam to the beach, was bombed for a couple of hours, came home in a paddle steamer. His voice sounds like that because he can't hear himself. You get that way after you've been bombed a few hours, he said. I return you now to Columbia in New York.
Can you tell us a bit more about the evacuation? This is the little ships, as commonly termed.
Yeah, so this is an event that's gone down in the mythology of Britain's Second World War. It's Churchill himself, though, who says that wars are not won by withdrawals. Mostly, the credit has to go to the Royal Navy, as obviously they are the ones who plan it, and they are the ones who do most of the actual evacuating troops. The little ships, they're called up from ports all across England, and they are encouraged to make their way to France and help with the evacuation. But the role of the little ships is actually to take troops off the beaches where the warships can't get close enough to the beach and to take them out to the larger ships. And it's the larger ships who actually ferry them back to Britain. So it's a combined effort. And this image we have of soldiers wading out and then being picked up by these paddle steamers or whatever little fishing vessels and being taken all the way back to Britain. Mm-hmm. That happens in some cases, but not in most cases. It's the Navy's victory here. And as I say, it's also the RAF's victory for keeping the Luftwaffe off the ships. Also, a lot of it has to go to the French army, of course, because they are holding the perimeter. Further afield as well, there is a French army that's surrounded in the city of Lille and go down fighting for quite a long time, tying down German divisions. Eventually, about 50,000 men there surrender. But they buy valuable time for the beachhead to be established and the evacuation to take place. And it's the same in the actual Dunkirk perimeter itself. And when most of the BEF has been picked up, the Navy then starts evacuating French troops, but about 40,000 of them are left behind and taken prisoner when the British escape. So credit has to go to them.
What's the scale of the evacuation? I mean, how many people were actually evacuated?
It's really impressive, actually. So in the end, it's about 192,000 British and 139,000 French troops. So the total is about 331,000. So it's a really significant operation. And to do it so quickly, kind of under enemy fire, it's beyond actually the expectations of any of the planners and the British government. Churchill's line around this time is to start preparing people for news of a complete disaster, that the army has basically been destroyed. And thankfully, that doesn't take place. They get most of the troops back. Of course, as a fighting force, the army is very badly damaged because they have to leave behind so much of their equipment. They lose basically all of their tanks, trucks, guns, large amounts of supplies. And those are all captured by the Germans.
So it's personnel they've prioritised.
It's personnel who are important and will keep Britain in a situation where they can think about repelling a German invasion and then going on to actually fight in theatres overseas and then eventually back in France. The Germans have almost, with this halt order, they've sort of snatched defeat from the jaws of victory, or at least they've severely limited their victory here because they could have destroyed the French and the British in one go and they failed to do that. This is the biggest German mistake of the campaign. This campaign has gone very, very well for them and they've been lucky and they've played it well. But this is a huge error because it allows the British to escape. It's an error shared by the generals on the ground who order the halt and Hitler, who is happy to confirm the order. They miss a golden opportunity.
On the station, I watched the men climbing into the long waiting trains. It was astounding to walk along carriage after carriage full of soldiers and to find in each one silence. For most of the men were fast asleep where they sat. All the way along the line, the people of England stood at the level crossings and in the back gardens to wait. And so the men of the BEF came home.
Among those paddle steamers that will never return was one that I knew well, for it was the pride of our ferry service to the Isle of Wight, none other than the good ship Gracie Fields. But now, look, this little steamer, like all her brave and battered sisters, is immortal. She'll go sailing proudly down the years in the epic of Dunkirk. And our great-grandchildren, when they learn how we began this war by snatching glory out of defeat and then swept on to victory, may also learn how the little holiday steamers made an excursion to hell and came back glorious.
With the evacuation, is that all the British have left France now?
Well, no, because the assumption is often made that, you know, Dunkirk happens and then that's it, the British are back in Britain. But actually, there are a fair few British formations who are south of that pocket and they're still in France. There are actually plans to re-establish the BEF and keep fighting in France, but these don't come to much because the German attack comes too quickly. One entire division, the 51st Highland Division, is actually cut off and forced to surrender when it's sort of pinned against the coast with no way to escape. And eventually the rest of the British forces in France are evacuated in what's been called a sort of second Dunkirk. And that's another 200,000 men, so it's a substantial number of people. It also leads to a maritime disaster, which is worse than anything that happened at Dunkirk, which is when the RMS Lancastria is sunk by German bombers just after leaving Saint-Nazaire. And we don't know how many people were on that ship because it was so overcrowded. They basically stopped counting how many people were on the ship. But estimates are that up to about 4,000 people are killed. So it's an enormous loss of life. There is actually a minor cover-up to stop this getting back to the British public because the scale of the loss is so great. From a signals intelligence point of view, there is also a bit of a story here in that there are intercept stations in the field, especially listening into the German Air Force. And these actually were employing a few of the officers who were trained at the government code cipher school, who'd been at Bletchley sort of the tail end of 1939. One of these I managed to find in the archives was based out on the Ile Sainte-Marguerite, just off Cannes in the south of France. Not the logical place you'd think to be at this stage in the war, but actually they're listening into the Italians. And it's a really good place to listen into what the Italians are doing. The Italians, of course, will intervene in the Battle of France just towards the end, just so Mussolini can say that he helped. This Y station is there until the 16th of June, and then their operations record book says they proceeded to Marseille, where they were twice embarked on the wrong ships, before leaving on SS Finland on the 17th of May 1940. And one of the people involved in this is a Flight Lieutenant Baghino, who was trained at GCNCS and then came back afterwards and would work on Italian codes and later on Japanese for the rest of the war. So, you know, the idea that we have of people actually being cut off from the fighting is, in some cases, those boundaries are broken down very considerably because they had had this mad scramble to get out of France right at the end.
Both people from Bletchley going out to the front, but also people coming back having experienced that and then working at Bletchley Park in Buckinghamshire.
It must have seemed like quite a cushy gig in comparison.
You said there was quite a big French force still to the south of this. They, I guess, still had to be dealt with.
Yeah, so the Battle of France goes on, and actually a lot of those French troops who are evacuated from Dunkirk, they are immediately repatriated. And, you know, the intention is obviously for France to keep fighting. So the Germans prepare for the second phase of the campaign, which they call a Case Red, Fallrot, and eventually launch an attack south against the French army. At this point, it turns into a bit more of a slog for the Germans. The French, their sort of battlefield techniques are improving. Morale is pretty high when the Germans attack. Resistance is quite tough. It's more of an infantry battle, and German casualties are quite heavy at this stage. But the French, inevitably, they lose out because they've lost all of those high-quality armoured divisions. And as Churchill discovered, they don't have much of a strategic reserve, if any, at this stage. So eventually, German superiority starts to win out and they start making progress. Paris is evacuated around the 10th of June and is actually captured by the Germans on the 14th. The French declare an open city, so there's no fighting over Paris. The Germans just walk in and the French government relocates to Bordeaux.
Das Oberkommando der Wehrmacht gibt bekannt, der völlige Zusammenbruch der ganzen französischen Front zwischen dem Ärmelkanal und der Maginot-Linie bei Montmédy.
The French resistance has collapsed and the Maginot line has been broken, destroying all French resistance. Paris is an open city.
Paris ist infolgedessen zur offenen Stadt erklärt worden.
I stayed in Paris until late yesterday afternoon and was one of the last three British journalists to leave the capital. But that last day in Paris was unforgettable. It was only the day before that things really began to change, that the war really seemed to have come to Paris. Our hotel let us stay the Tuesday night on the understanding that there would be no service. The next morning, we got up to a city which was a city of the dead. A Paris which no one has ever seen before. Scarcely a single shop was open. But what chiefly struck me, I think, was that two of the great features were missing. There were no newspapers, and scarcely a single cafe was open. Breakfast in the hotel was out of the question, so my two colleagues and I went out in search of somewhere we could get a cup of coffee. After a long search, we found one, and we sat on the deserted terrace outside and ordered our breakfast. After breakfast, I drove round Paris, round all its famous streets. I drove up the Champs-Élysées. It was quite unrecognizable. Scarcely a soul was walking along the pavement. All the cafes were closed. Down the middle, a few belated refugees drove their cars stacked with baggage and household belongings. But at the top, by the unknown soldier's grave under the Arc de Triomphe, the lamp was still burning. And so, later in the afternoon, I left Paris. A sad, deserted Paris, which I never want to see again like that.
We hear the church bells ringing again today, ringing the tidings of the entry of German troops into Paris. And tonight, the swastika flag of Adolf Hitler's Third Reich flutters from the Eiffel Tower there by the Seine, in that Paris which so many of us know, or hope to know, or see before we die. Germans capture Paris. Those are magic words to many people here. And for one thing, they hope to wipe out the bitter memories of 1918, which had lain so long, 22 years, in the German soul.
The political situation in France is now moving towards thinking about an armistice with the Germans. On the 16th of June, the French Prime Minister Paul Reynaud resigns, and his deputy since May had been Philippe Pétain, who is this incredibly well thought of general of the First World War, hero of Verdun, and he commanded the French army at the end of the First World War, and he's a national hero, and he becomes the new prime minister. Very soon after coming to power, Pétain is looking to reach terms with the Germans, and the Germans also are acknowledging the need for an armistice with France rather than going for some sort of unconditional surrender. The problem the Germans have is France controls an enormous empire, and it's a naval power, and that's unmatched by the Germans. And the Germans are worried that if they continue, either France's navy will fall into the hands of the British, or that they're going to be able to continue the war from overseas in the same way the Dutch government has done, with a sort of a government in exile and fighting on from the colonies. So in a way, the Germans also have to persuade the French that an armistice is in their best interest. And if it can come to an agreement, that means the French basically sit out the rest of the war. And this is what they agree on the 22nd of June. The armistice is signed at Compiègne, which is where the First World War armistice was signed.
The armistice negotiations here on the same spot where the last armistice was signed in 1918, here in Compiègne Forest, a warm June sun beat down on the great elm and pine trees and cast pleasant shadows on the wooded avenues as Herr Hitler, with the German plenipotentiaries at his side, appeared. He pauses and slowly looks around. Hitler's personal standard is run up on a small post in the center of the circular opening in the wood. Also in the center is a great granite block. Hitler, followed by the others, walks slowly over to it, steps up, and reads the inscription engraved in great high letters on that block. And the inscription says, "Here, on the 11th of November 1918, succumbed the criminal pride of the German Empire, vanquished by the free peoples which it tried to enslave." Hitler reads it, and we look for the expression on Hitler's face. But it does not change. And the German leader stride over to the armistice car. This car, of course, was not standing on this spot yesterday. It was standing 75 yards down the rusty track in the shelter of a tiny museum. Yesterday, the car was removed from the museum by a German army engineer and rolled back those 75 yards to the spot where it stood on the morning of November 11th, 1918.
Hitler is very careful to milk this occasion for its propaganda value and, you know, its value for him personally. He is very happy to see France defeated, and he takes pleasure in the fact that they signed the armistice in the same place as last time. He sees it as vengeance for what happened to Germany at the end of the First World War and in the Treaty of Versailles. So they have this quite choreographed procedure of signing the armistice, and at one point Hitler leaves the room and leaves the proceedings to his subordinates in a way to sort of snub the French delegation. He really just enjoyed the experience.
Exactly at 3:30 p.m., the French alight from Car. The French plenipotentiaries pass the guard of honor, drawn up at the entrance to the clearing. The guard snaps to attention for the French, but does not present arms. The Frenchmen keep their eyes straight ahead. Their faces are solemn, drawn, but they're the picture of tragic dignity. The Frenchmen enter Marshal Foch's Pullman car. Hitler, so far as we can see through the windows just in front of us there, does not say anything. He nods to General Keitel at his side. We can see General Keitel adjusting his papers. He is reading the preamble of the German armistice terms. The French sit there with marble-like faces and listen intently. 3:32, we see Hitler stand up, salute stiffly with hand upraised. Then he strides out of the drawing room. The French remain at the green-top table in the old Pullman car, and we see General Keitel remains with them. He is going to read them the detailed conditions of the armistice. Hitler, Goering, and the others do not wait for this. They walk down the avenue back towards the Alsace-Lorraine monument. As they pass the guard of honor, the German band strikes up the two national anthems, Deutschland über alles, and the horse vessel song. The whole thing has taken but a quarter of an hour, this great reversal of a historical act.
They signed the document in the railway carriage where the last armistice was signed. And afterwards, the carriage is taken to Germany and displayed in Berlin as a sort of war trophy. Since the First World War, this whole area had been turned into a sort of memorial. And 3 days after signing the armistice, the Germans start to basically level all of these monuments and leave a waste ground. And the one statue which they leave standing is the statue of Ferdinand Foch, who had been the Allied Supreme Commander in the First World War, just so he then would preside over a wasteland.
We shall go on to the end. We shall fight in France. We shall fight on the seas and oceans. We shall fight with growing confidence and growing strength in the air. We shall defend our island, whatever the cost may be. We shall fight on the beaches. We shall fight on the landing grounds. We shall fight in the fields and in the streets. We shall fight in the hills. We shall never surrender. And if, which I do not for a moment believe, this island or a large part of it were subjugated and starving, then our empire beyond the seas, armed and guarded by the British fleet, would carry on the struggle until, in God's good time, the new world with all its power and might steps forth to the rescue and the liberation of the old.
We have spoken a lot about what took place, but not much about Bletchley Park. What did they actually do?
There isn't an enormous contribution from Sigint on the battle itself, but actually for Bletchley Park, this is one of the most crucial periods of the war. They are busier than ever before with the German network sort of lighting up and traffic increasing. And it's a turning point, or at least it could be, because this is the point in the war where Bletchley Park could have lost Enigma and never regained it. Because they're so busy, Denniston actually issues a rare sort of order of the day to all the staff.
23rd of May, 1940. Order of the day. To all. Every member of GCNCS is making her or himself an important cog in a large machine which is producing definite valuable war material, and it is now increasingly hard to spare any of you. So I would like to ask you all first to avoid accumulating rest days for the next few weeks. You must have your rest days. You need it. I realize that most of you wish to use it to see your friends and relations in various parts of the country. but I should be very grateful indeed if the habit of local leave could be extended during the present overwhelming crisis. I know this will entail a very great sacrifice for many of you. This war must and will be won by us and our allies. The consequences of defeat, or even a draw, are too calamitous to merit consideration. Now is the moment for every effort. A very great Frenchman has said, "Hold out for a month, and victory is three parts ours." Our own leaders are calling for sacrifice and effort from every member of the nation. We know ours is a useful part. Let's just play it for this month with no thought but for victory. Signed, A.G. Denniston.
Why is it such a crisis for Bletchley Park?
So the crisis is in Hut 6, Army Air Enigma, and it's about how the Germans send their Enigma messages. They change their procedures, and they actually do this on the 1st of May in preparation for the battle. And it's about the indicators. If you imagine an Enigma machine, you set up the machine differently every day, and you do that according to a key sheet that's sent out to all the different stations on the German radio networks. And there's basically two broad elements as to how you set up a machine. There's the daily settings, and then there's a setting that relates to a particular message. You set up the wires on the plug board, and you select three rotors out of a choice of five, and you set the rings on the rotors, which offset the wiring inside the rotor from the letters on the outside. You do that every day. But for each message, what you do is you have to set the rotors to a different position. You have three rotors, and they can obviously all go to 26 different positions.
And those are the letters you see in the windows at the top of the machine when you're about to start your message.
Exactly. So your letters in the window are the important thing here. And when you send a message to somebody else, you start this with what's called an indicator, where you tell them which letters they need to be showing in their little windows. And this indicator has two parts. It has a part which is basically sent in plain text in clear, and it has a second encrypted part. And if you have all the other components of the machine set up in the correct way, you put your rotors to the positions shown by the first part of the indicator, and you type in the text of the second part, and you get three letters out of the machine, and those are the indicators. That's your message setting. That is your rotor positions that you need to set up to actually decrypt the message itself. And up to this point in the war, the Germans have done that encryption of their indicators twice.
To be more secure?
Well, no, it's a security weakness. It's to guard against garbles and mistakes in transmission. So you type in six letters and you should get the same three letters out repeated.
Right.
So it's to check that you've got the correct indicator. But this is a security weakness, and this is the weakness that Bletchley Park and before them the Polish codebreakers have been exploiting. Because whenever there is a repeated letter in the first and the fourth, second and the fifth, or third and the sixth position, that tells you something about the relationship between those two indicators, then that's basically a crib.
I see. So just a shortcut into the daily setting. What kind of information would having this indicator give you?
They call that repeater female. Mm-hmm. And there's only a certain number of positions of the machine that can produce a female.
Right.
And if you intercept enough messages and find enough females, then you can start stacking your net sheets, your Zagowski sheets, which we've talked about in a previous episode. If you stack enough sheets, you rule out possibilities, basically. And eventually you rule out all the possibilities. You will put this on a light table, and light will shine through a single hole, and there will be no other holes in the sheets. And that will indicate your machine setting for the day.
Goodness.
But you don't need to understand all this, because at this point in the war, the Germans stopped producing females, so that doesn't work anymore. The net sheets are useless. They can go in the bin, burn them, whatever you want.
So these sheets that were invented by the Poles, shared with the British, and that the British helped to make, suddenly of no more use.
Useless, waste paper.
Wow.
Yeah. So Hut 6 have to start almost from scratch. They have to find techniques which don't rely on these females, which have been the linchpin of all their breaking up to this point. Luckily, Hut 6 have been thinking about alternative ways of breaking Enigma, and they're also helped, as usual, by the Germans, because they bring in the new system over a few days. And this means basically Bletchley are able to work out what the change has been. They know what the problem is, but they just have to work out how to overcome it. And one of the techniques they come up with is called sillies.
Sillies is a strange name. What are sillies and why are they called sillies?
Why they're called sillies, we're not entirely sure. The story that's often told is that there was a German operator whose girlfriend was called Silly, or the first three letters of her name was C-I-L. This came up because this is a technique based on predictable indicators. The operators have to come up with six letters, the two parts of the indicator, which are random. And people are very, very bad at coming up with random patterns, as we know, as anyone who has tried to come up with a password will know well. So this technique doesn't really work before the battle breaks out, because the Germans have time and they are very careful with their procedures. Once battle breaks out, the volume of messages goes up and everyone is very rushed and has a million things to do. The standards start to slip and they start to send messages with indicators which are predictable.
Mm-hmm.
And these take the form of, you know, the name of someone's girlfriend or the name Hitler or place names, predictable, pronounceable words.
Like Berlin or...
Yeah. The cryptanalysts in Hut 6 get very good at spotting these words. And sometimes, if it's obvious enough, you can just guess the second half of the indicator. So if you see HIT, you can guess the second part might be LER. The other thing the Germans do is keyboard patterns, you know, because it's right in front of you. So you spell out a pattern on the keyboard.
Or just do QWE, for example.
Yeah, you do QWE, and then for the second half, you do RTZ. So if you see the start of a pattern, you can often complete it. They do QAY, which is the leftmost letters on the German keyboard. So the next part of the indicator will be the next line across. And they get very good at spotting these as well. So often you can guess what the encrypted part of the indicator is. And then again, you've got a crib.
Right.
And if you have enough of these cribs, I think Gordon Welshman says you need about 6 of these, which is not very many. And then you can start breaking the key for the day. You know, it takes a lot of very clever working out, but it is a key weakness they can exploit. But there's another dimension to Seelies which goes beyond that. It's about how multi-part messaging works. Each Enigma message has a limit of about 250 characters, which is laid down by the German High Command, because the cryptographic principle is the longer a message is, the easier it is to break. So you split it into sections, and each of these is encrypted at a different position of the machine, and that shortens the length of your cipher key, and therefore it's meant to be more secure.
Like threads on a tweet, so it's not like you have to fit it all in just a few words. You've got to have a number of them.
And if these are long operational orders, they might go to 3, 4, 5 parts. But again, once the Germans have sent the first part of a message, they have to come up with a separate indicator for the next part. And sometimes they look at the letters in the windows of the machine, whatever they might be, and they look like 3 random letters. And they go, that's as random as anything else. I'll just use those letters. And then those letters are sent in plain text at the start of the next part of the message.
Just to get this, then, that means that they are sending in plain text on part B of the message, the setting of the Enigma machine that was the last setting on the previous bit of the message.
Yes. So they also send at the start of every message the length of the message. So even if the Y stations haven't intercepted the entire message, they always know how long it is, almost always. So you count backwards.
To work out the setting at the start of that message and all the information's there for you.
Yeah. Of course, it's a bit more complicated than this because of the turnover positions of the rotors.
Mm-hmm.
The rotors only turn over, they only move at certain points, and those don't change. You can account for them if you know where the turnover positions are, as Hut 6 did. So you count back to the start of the message, and you work out what are the indicators that could have been used for this message based on what I know about where the rotors will be moving. And again, this is a lot of working out, but it's not impossible compared to 103,000 million, million, million settings. This is quite workoutable. And then you might be left with 6 indicators based on different rotor orders. But if you can look at one of those and identify it as a silly, identify it as something that's predictable, and that has a relationship to the first half of the indicator which you've intercepted in plain text, then not only do you have a crib, you also know what the rotor order is.
So you're most of the way there, really, for that particular message.
Yeah. And the third thing you need to find out is the ring setting. And the Germans set this every day, and it offsets the letters on the outside of the rotor from the wiring on the inside.
It just sort of moves around on the outside incrementally.
Yeah, and it's got a little sort of latch which allows you to move them separately of each other. And the technique here all comes down to a man called John Herivelle, who's been in Hut 6 since around the start of the year.
Now, what I want to talk about to begin with is mostly about Gordon Welshman. Of course, he was my supervisor at Cambridge. And for 2 years, Malcolm Chamberlain and I went into him once a week with problems which he had set us to solve. And when we got in, he always opened the filing cabinet, got out a few bits of paper, looked up the skeleton solution of the problems that he had proposed, and then proceeded to discuss our solution, criticize them, or praise them. So this went on week after week for 2 years. And so I didn't really learn very much about him, except that he was a methodical person, he was encouraging, and he gave me the impression he had a fairly open mind. The next time I met him was much more dramatic. The war broke out in September 1939, and Welshman immediately came to Bletchley. He disappeared. There were rumours in the college that he was doing some very important secret work in Bletchley, but nobody, of course, knew what it was, and they never did. And then the following January, towards the end of the month, I was just about to begin to do some revision when there was a knock at the door, and in darted Gordon Welshman, of course I never called him Gordon, and asked me whether I'd like to come to Bletchley, so far it was, and do some very important work. As I was just about to have to do a revision, I was only too glad to agree to escape from this toil, and on the 29th of January 1940, I found myself at Bletchley. And of course, only a few weeks later, I had this happy inspiration, which eventually was christened the Herald Tip by Welshman. Actually, Tony Kendrick had a much nicer name for it. We called it Herivalismus, which I prefer. However, Herald Tip it must be. So a few weeks later, I had this idea, and I went into Hut 6 the next day and told my colleagues, of whom there were very few. There was David Rees, there was Melton Chamberlain, there was myself, and there was Welshman, and there was Dennis Babbage. I told them about this, and Welshman immediately saw the possibility of this working, because, you see, it's very difficult to know what to call the Herivalism. It's not a theory. It's not exactly a speculation. What it really said was that under certain circumstances, it's possible that some people may be rather slack. And in that case, if you look at all the first three letters of all the first messages of the day, you'll get some idea about the ringstone. So that it was all a matter of possibilities and probabilities and so on. But one thing I was very clear about from the beginning was that it would be much more likely to happen if the operators, German operators, were working under great stress in their office. People make mistakes when they're frightened or in a hurry or very tired. So Welshman immediately cottoned on to this. He must have, because he ordered the receiving station to send these first messages of the day each day to Bletchley Park as soon as possible.
Even before the Battle of France breaks out, he's frustrated with how long it takes to break Enigma every day using the sheets. He's thinking about ways you might shorten the process. And he's trying to get into the mind of the German operator. And the story, as he tells it, is that he's sitting in front of the fire one evening in his digs, thinking about what the German operator does when he sets up the machine. So he looks at the key sheet and he starts off with choosing the three rotors. And he puts them on the spindle and puts them in the machine. And then the next column on the key sheet is the ring setting. And so the operator, you know, uses his little latch to set the rings on the rotors in turn. And then he closes the lid of the machine. And then he either sets up to send his first message, or maybe he goes off, because this is at midnight, maybe he goes off duty and somebody else comes back. And whoever's using the machine looks at the little windows, and they do the same thing as with the sillies. They say, well, those three letters look random enough to me. I'll just use them for my indicator. The key thing here is that once you set the ring, then the letter you've set the ring setting to will normally be pointing upwards. And then that's where your rotors will be when you close the flap on the top of the machine and get ready to send the first message. And then again, those are sent in plain at the start of the message. So very often, that means the indicator used on a particular network for the first message of the day are very close to the ring setting of the day.
It's so fantastic as well, because that's come from an understanding of human behaviour rather than, say, a mathematical solution to something.
Yeah.
I think it's quite so different to the way that people often think that these breakthroughs or realizations were made, you know, it was all sort of mathematical genius, but actually this is simply sitting there and
the fact is, however clever you are, you cannot just work this out. It is far too complicated.
Yeah.
You need to increase your odds substantially, and you do that by getting into the mind of your opponent and spotting when they've made an error. Mm-hmm. And the Weiss stations, of course, are able to identify different German radio stations and know which is the first message of the day. So they're able to tell Bletchley this information. It's elegant how this information was actually compiled together, because he does it on a grid where two columns are the first two letters of the indicator and The third letter is indicated by a space on the grid. And this means that when your messages come through in the registration room of Hut 6, the first message of each network on each day gets plotted on this grid called a Herrenville square. And then you start to see a grouping. If you start to see a grouping, then you know you're pretty close to the ring setting for the day. And again, it's just a matter of trying maybe six positions for the rings. And then you've turned 103,000 million, million, million possible permutations of the machine into, you know, a solid rotor order and a small number of ring settings. And you've got cribs to work out the actual rotor positions of a message. And actually the stecker board, the plug board, which is the most complex part of the machine, mathematically speaking, it's also the part which is easiest to break by hand using the human brain rather than any other machinery. Because if you have a good enough understanding of German language, you can see where a letter has been substituted for another or whether you're seeing part of a plain text German sentence. Mm-hmm. So they always do that bit by hand, even when the bomb machines come in later in the war. They always have to do that bit by hand and they just get very good at it. And it's ironic that the mathematically most complex part of the machine is the part that it's least important to mechanise breaking.
At this point, then you have not even just a realistic proposition of being able to work out the settings of a particular message and therefore other messages. This relatively understandable, I have to say, series of systems and processes, actually it gets you there once you have this breakthrough, once you have this ability that seems to have been given to you by the Herrenville tip and the Herrenville square and so on. Were they just breaking Enigma all over the place then as soon as this happened?
The first half of May, they don't have much luck. They have to wait to get enough messages through. They have to wait for the operators to get sloppy. But that does happen. The Herrenville tip had never worked since Herrenville had invented it earlier in the year, but it does start working during the Battle of France.
Right.
And then the Germans are using sillies and making all sorts of other errors which help. It's on the 22nd of May that Bletchley break the red key for the 20th of May. The red key is the general German Army Air Corporation key. It's by far the most important. They break it through the entire war, apart from this period in early May 1940. But it will be sort of the mainstay of what Hut 6 does all the way through the rest of the war. And this is when they prove that their techniques work and they break in. And then once they've broken in, because they know the characteristics of the networks and the mistakes the operators make and the content of the messages, that helps them stay in. They call it continuity. Continuity is the most important factor here. And it makes it much easier to keep reading a network once you've broken into it than it did to break it in the first place. So after they break red on the 22nd of May, they keep reading it for the rest of the war. The ironic thing here actually is that they start reading red quicker than before, because with the sheets, they had to get a certain number of females through before they could start stacking the sheets, and that would maybe take a few hours. But now they have techniques which will work on the first few messages sent every day, so they can sometimes break red within an hour or two and then be reading messages at leisure by the early hours of the morning.
With all of these successes and so many more messages being decrypted, what's the impact of this?
Actually, very limited. The fact is that by the time Bletchley Park starts reading Enigma again, the battle has basically been lost. And even if there were people at the battlefronts reading this information, which often there aren't, there are concerns about whether it's going to the right people. There is a network set up by SIS to get Enigma messages to commanders in the field. But by that point in May, obviously they're in retreat. We don't have very much information on it, but it's doubtful whether those systems were all working very well at that stage. And even when the intelligence did get there, whether anyone was listening to it is pretty doubtful. It's still being presented as agents' reports. And as we know, treated with a great degree of scepticism.
Because they were seen as hearsay or potentially unreliable.
Yeah. What actually happens during the battle is that Lord Gort, in command of the BEF, leaves his headquarters and sets up a sort of battle command post further forward, but leaves all his intelligence staff back at GHQ, which means intelligence isn't being fed back to the intelligence people to analyse it, and their conclusions are not being fed forward to the commander. So there are real problems in command and control in the BEF, as we've seen at this stage. Mm-hmm. Soon they're all too busy retreating to do anything else. So Ultra doesn't have a huge amount of impact. Commander Saunders, in charge of Hut 3, actually writes a memo at this point in late May complaining about this very thing.
Passing of information from our source to right authorities. Everyone in the know is conscious in these critical times of how important and decisive our information can be. Could we have the assurance of CSS that our intelligence does actually reach the responsible authorities in sufficient time, and that these authorities are fully aware of the reliability of the source? I ask this for several reasons. A. Because there is evidence that in the Norwegian campaign, the information was not getting to headquarters in Norway, or not getting there with anything like sufficient speed. B. Because we've recently sent out a number of items of intelligence foretelling enemy movements or concentrations, which if acted upon in time would have produced far-reaching successes. For instance, we gave 8 hours notice of the conferences of the chiefs of German Fliegerkorps at a certain chateau on the 26th of May. It might have been worthwhile to blow up the chateau with bombs at 09:30 GMT, or about half an hour after the prominent Fliegergeneräle had settled around the table. C. It would act as a great tonic to all our hard-working people in both huts to know that this kind of valuable intelligence is being assimilated by our war leaders. Signed, M.G. Saunders, 28th of May, 1940.
Bertrand at the Deuxième Bureau is having similar problems with the information that the French are feeding to their commanders, and he says he's feeding un confiserie au cochon. He's feeding sweets to swine.
Harsh.
Very harsh. These problems are right across the board at this point.
So if they're disguising this intelligence as agents' reports, and this isn't a successful way of doing it, why do that? Why not just read more people in to the secret?
Because of security, because they're worried about the Germans finding out and changing all their ciphers. The main preoccupation of the British sort of SIGINT service at this point is security, at the expense sometimes of actually getting the intelligence to the right people. And obviously with France collapsing, the concern is what is going to happen to the French codebreakers and to the Polish. The French and the Poles evacuate from Paris on the 10th of June. Actually, they keep intercepting and breaking Enigma as sort of a mobile column for a few more days, but that doesn't last too long. And they move to the south of France. And it's not long before the armistice is signed. And then the question for the British is what's going to happen to the Poles and the French. And there is a very anxious correspondence between Denniston and Bertrand. They use a special cipher to communicate.
Messages to and from Bertrand. These messages are sent by SISWT. The code used is a French code belonging to Commander Denniston and will be found, together with instructions for use, in an envelope with the watch organiser. Outgoing messages. Outgoing messages are to be numbered in sequence on the appropriate card in the Ronio card index. The serial number is to be encoded as the first text of the message. Outgoing messages are to be signed to Denniston in code. Typing. A copy of the outgoing message is to be sent to Commander Denniston in a sealed envelope. There is no further circulation of these messages. Filing. The pink encode form is to be filed in the appropriate box file in the code section steel cupboard. Working figures are to be filed in the appropriate folder in the code section steel cupboard. Incoming messages. A green decode form and one white copy is to be made of all incoming messages. Between the hours of 10:00 and 18:00, the white copy is to be sent to Commander Denniston in a sealed envelope. Between the hours of 18:00 and 10:00, any message which suggests that immediate action is required is to be phoned to Commander Denniston at Salisbury 7. The white copy of all messages is to be placed in an envelope and given to Commander Denniston at 10:00 hours. There is no further circulation of these messages.
And Denniston is very anxious to make sure that no compromising material is going to fall into the hands of the Germans, and that especially that the personnel aren't going to be captured.
To Bertrand, 23rd of June, 1940.
Numéro 1. Vous, les officiers de votre état-major. Number 1. You and the officers of your staff, as well as your Polish colleagues, will be very welcome with us. Contact either Lieutenant Fleming or Winnie in Bayonne and embark there.
S'adresser ou au Lieutenant Fleming
ou à Winnie à Bayonne et y embarquer.
To Bertrand, 23rd of June, 1940.
Numéro 2. Mon chef désire savoir quels sont les plans. Number 2. My boss would like to know, what are the plans of your boss? Signed, Dolinoff.
De la part de Dolinoff.
To Bertrand, 25th of June, 1940.
Numéro 4. Je vous prie de répondre à mes télégrammes. Number 4. Please reply to my telegrams regarding your plans and those of your friends. We have received only, repeat, only your telegram the 25th, to which the response is that we have nothing to send at this time. Number your telegrams from now on.
Rien envoyé pour le moment. Numérotez de suite vos télégrammes.
From Bertrand, 25th of June, 1940, 21:30.
Numéro 2465. Number 2465. Current plan is to continue working under similar conditions.
Dans pareilles conditions.
From Bertrand, 26th of June, 1940, 0925.
Pour Dolinov, en réponse à telegram numéro 1. Merci. For Dolinov, in response to telegram number 1. Wholehearted thanks for your invitation. As far as our Polish friends are concerned, they'd been evacuated by plane before we received your telegram. It may no longer be possible to send them to you. As for the duty officer, the command opposes all movement at this time.
Quant aux officiers du service, le commandement s'oppose à tout mouvement en ce moment.
To Bertrand, from Deniston, 26th of June, 1940.
Bertrand, votre télégramme 4 du 26. Bertrand, your telegram 4 of the 26th. My boss is counting on you for the security of our work. Your telegram 2465. From where do you plan to continue working? Deniston.
De quel endroit comptez-vous continuer travailler?
Deniston.
From Bertrand to Deniston. 28th of June 1940. 1615.
Pour Dolinov. Sommes obligés de cesser trafic radio en raison. For Dolinov. We are obliged to cease radio traffic due to armistice conditions. We ask you to please continue listening every day in the same way, because we hope to resume soon secretly. You can count on me to keep your work safe. Your friend, Bertrand.
Pour sécuriser votre travail.
And ici, Bertrand.
So ultimately Bertrand assures Deniston he's going to keep the secret, not to worry, and then they're out of contact. On the 28th of June, all contact ceases. It will not be resumed until 1941. The Polish codebreakers actually go to Algeria. They're withdrawn to Algeria initially, and then actually they return to France later that year, where Bruno sets up a new codebreaking station. He calls it Poste de Commandant Cadiz. It's in the south of France, in a secluded house in the countryside, away from any prying eyes. And it's a very interesting story about how Bertrand basically plays off the Vichy French authorities and the British against each other. And the Poles, meanwhile, are working with their own intelligence services, working with the French to intercept material, but letting the French think they're working for them, but actually working for the Polish government in London. They work on this material in the south of France at the new station until March 1941. And they come back into contact with SIS.
So you've spoken about the Polish codebreakers. Can you tell us a bit more about the French codebreakers that we know were at BP?
Yeah, so when the armistice is signed, these French officers are meant to go back to France. But actually, a number intend to stay on at BP. This is until one of the most controversial events in Franco-British relations. I've talked before about the French fleet, about anxieties about whether that's going to fall into German hands. And this is a real concern of Churchill and the whole Royal Navy. After the Royal Navy, it's the second most powerful ocean-going fleet in the world. If it falls into German hands, that would possibly lose the war at a stroke. It's in harbour at Mersel Kabir, just outside Iran in Algeria. There are negotiations to try and bring the fleet to British territory, and the offer is refused. The alternatives are to scuttle the fleet or to take it to somewhere neutral, like the United States. And there is some controversy over whether these terms were communicated to the French leadership properly. But ultimately, they refuse all the British offers. And then Churchill eventually feels like he has no choice but to order the French fleet to be attacked. It is attacked, and several of the French ships are sunk and others are damaged. One battleship makes its way back to France. This is very controversial at the time, and I honestly think that the British government didn't think it had a choice and it didn't think it could take the risk. But obviously, nobody in France is happy about being attacked by their former ally. And so after this, a lot of the French officers at Bletchley, who would have stayed on, go back to France, or some of them join the Free French, some of them join French embassy staff in London. Only four of them stay at Bletchley: Veil, Mirambel, Baudouin and Meslin. So two of the naval officers and two of the air force officers. The problem that they have is that under the terms of the armistice, if they stay in Britain and keep working for the British, they would become stateless. They would lose their nationality. So they have to, along with Denniston, come up with a bit of a ruse. They tell the Vichy government, the new French collaboration government, that these men have been interned in Oxford, where enemy aliens are interned, but actually they stay at BP under false names.
British names, so completely new identities.
Yeah, so Monsieur Vey becomes Mr. Volney, Mirambel becomes Mr. Merry, Baudouin becomes Baldwin, of course, and Merlin becomes Miller. We can look in the records of some of the staffers at BP and we see these French officers under their British names. They keep living in Stony Stratford. The two naval officers were accomplished musicians and one of them brought his wife and daughter over. They set up a bit of a chamber orchestra and they played in the hotel where they were staying in the evenings along with some of the locals. So these are really typical Bletchley types, like musicians, and they're very intellectual people. You can imagine they fit right in and you can see why they'd want to stay. These French officers keep working at Bletchley until 1942, when they moved down to London to work in another part of MI6. The reason for that is probably because this is just before the American contingent starts arriving, and the Americans have been told that this is a British code-breaking establishment.
No French here.
Exactly. And they haven't been let in on the fact that there are French people here. For security reasons, obviously, that would worry them. So the French officers are quietly sidelined to a different job. One of them has a sad fate, unfortunately. Baudouin, he's well sought after by French intelligence and continues working with them based in North Africa. And he goes out there a few different times. This sort of intelligence network will be very important when the Americans and the British come to invade North Africa. But on one occasion, he's flying out to Algeria from an airfield in Cornwall in April 1944. And the plane he's on crashes soon after taking off and he's killed. So that's a loss to French intelligence, a considerable talent in code breaking.
Yeah, and to British intelligence as well. You're talking about events that took place in 1942, in 1944, but that is with the hindsight that this was a success. In June 1940, that wasn't necessarily the picture, was it?
No, I mean, the start of 1940 for the Allies, for the British, is a disaster. They've gone from a very strong strategic situation where they're blockading Germany. They're looking forward to, in a few years' time, launching a victorious offensive against Germany. And in response to that, Germany takes this immense gamble by attacking France, which pays off beyond their wildest dreams. And the strategic situation flips on its head. Suddenly, the most powerful army in the world, the French army, is no more. France is out of the war. Britain is on its own. Germany controls the continent. It can threaten the Atlantic. It can threaten Britain itself from the air, from the sea, however it wants. So this is a period of obviously intense anxiety for the British. And it will take a long time for them to recover and be able to strike back effectively against Germany. It will take the Germans to make great strategic errors before that's possible. But for now, the British are definitely on the back foot. Faced with a German army on the continent, flush with success, it seems like for the Germans, the logical next step is going to be an invasion of Britain itself.
What General Weygand has called the Battle of France is over. The Battle of Britain is about to begin. Upon this battle depends the survival of Christian civilization. Upon it depends our own British life and the long continuity of our institutions and our empire. The whole fury and might of the enemy must very soon be turned on us. Hitler knows that he will have to break us in this island or lose the war. If we can stand up to him, all Europe may be freed, and the life of the world may move forward into broad, sunlit upland. But if we fail, then the whole world, including the United States, including all that we have known and cared for, will sink into the abyss of a new dark age, made more sinister and perhaps more protracted by the lights of perverted science. Let us therefore brace ourselves to our duty, and so bear ourselves that if the British Empire and its Commonwealth last for 1,000 years, men will still say, this was their finest hour.
Thanks to the paid and volunteer staff, visitors and veterans who took part in this podcast. To find out more, go to bletchleypark.org.uk. You can follow Bletchley Park on Twitter, Facebook and Instagram. This podcast is produced for the Bletchley Park Trust by MC Fontaine and supported by Audioboom. If you like this podcast, please leave us a review on iTunes. Thanks for listening, and we'll have more decrypts from the home of the Codebreakers next month.